Session number 10688, Reel 3.
Mr. Kitson, Reel 3.
The the rivets, the boxes that contained the rivets had to be taken back, and a box, a different coloured box with fresh rivets issued to you, and that went on for the whole... The rivets that you had used during the hour, if you kept them at the high temperature in the assembly part of the factory, became brittle, and so they had to use these rivets that were cooled. The speed at riveting got very fast because with a good pair of fitters, or riveters, who were highly trained, you could rivet at a terrific speed. One worked inside the ship and one worked outside the ship. And you could work up a tremendous speed as you riveted.
Why is there a difference in speed of riveting between round-headed and flush-headed rivets?
Well, we didn't use flush-headed rivets. We used round-headed rivets all the time.
Were people working hard just to make the money, or was there any sense of patriotism?
I don't think there was any sense of patriotism. Patriotism is a funny expression. I suppose from time to time we feel all patriotic, but I've served in disciplined forces all my life, and patriotism has never really come into the matter. During the war, I never thought about patriotism. I simply thought about what I was supposed to be doing. We knew it was going to be a long war, and I think the same applied to people working in a factory at that time. I think when the war started and women came into industry, the women were patriotic, and they worked very hard because a lot of the men folk were in the services and that sort of thing. But at the time I was working on aircraft, I don't think patriotism entered into it at all.
Did you have any women in your workforce?
Yes, we had women working on smaller aircraft where the wings were made of material. And the women sewed this material and doped it. But we never saw them, but they were in a different part of the factory altogether.
How did you join the forces?
Well, after I got home, I thought that it would be a good idea to join the Territorial Army so that when the war did break out, I would at least be on the ground floor. And so I went along to a drill hall in Liverpool with the intention of joining the Liverpool Scottish. When I got to the drill hall, there was a queue on the pavement of eager applicants to join the Territorials. So I fell in at the back of the queue and eventually got inside and filled the form up. Then I had a medical exam, which consisted of walking past the doctor, who said good evening. And that's all the conversation took place. And then I had the oath administered to me. And on the way out, I said to somebody, I'm pretty pleased I joined the Liverpool Scottish. And he said, you haven't joined the Liverpool Scottish, you've joined the Royal Signals. but I was quite satisfied with that. And now my Palestine police training came into the whole thing. Because everybody who had joined this particular unit, which was in the 55th West Lancashire Infantry Division, were recruits. They didn't know how to stand to attention or stand at ease or slope arms. And I found myself in a squad being instructed by a company sergeant major who showed us how to do all these things. But of course it was pretty sloppy. But my Palestine police training, of course, I was an expert on sloping arms and all the drill movements and everything. And quite obviously, when we got the command slope arms, I was doing it like a guardsman. And the following training now, I was called to the company commander's office, and he asked me if I had ever done this before, and I said, yes, I have. I was trained in Palestine Police in rifle and firearms, and musketry and foot drill and everything like that. And he said, do you know anything about map reading? And I said, yes, of course I do. And I didn't know a thing about map reading. So when I came home, I wasn't married at the time, but Irene lived not very far from where I was, and she was a librarian. So I popped down to her house and said, when you go to the library tomorrow, bring me some books on map reading. So next night she arrived at my digs with these two books. And I said, now, I don't really want to see you for about a week. I'm going to study map reading, which I did. And the next week I went back and I was given a trade test, and I passed it.
So you said you knew map reading because you were ambitious for promotion?
That's right. And I was immediately promoted to be a Lance Corporal. But I was always ambitious like that. I had a certain goal in front of me. I wanted to become a certain rank.
What were you aiming at?
I wanted to become a regimental sergeant major, and as quickly as possible. And I made a bit of a record in the British Army because I became a regimental sergeant major somewhere about 3 years after I joined. For several reasons. One was I got more money, I got more comfort, and I found that when I went abroad I got field allowances, which nobody else, no other rank got. Because I was a great believer in as much income as possible, because by that time I was married and my son was born just after I left this country. So it was important to me that my income was right and I could maintain my wife at home, you see. Having got that rank, then I was quite happy. Because the next rank up to get any more money would have been a major. And you can't be promoted from regimental sergeant major to a major. So I was quite satisfied with what I got then.
So I interrupted you with you being promoted to Lance Corporal.
Well, what happened then was that not very long after that, we were called up, mobilised, and I was still a Lance Corporal, and I was in a cable section. It's a section which laid field cable, and we laid cable to brigade and battalion and formations like that. That's what we were trained to do. In peacetime, they didn't have a lot of high ranks in the territorials. I think that was to save money. But on the day war broke out, on the 3rd of September, I looked at the orders on the board and found I'd been promoted to the rank of sergeant. And I was put in charge of the cable section, which consisted of 32 men. So that was a pretty quick jump from Lance Corporal to sergeant. The reason I think I got that promotion was that every job I've done, I've studied hard and concentrated on the job. And so I spent all my time doing things to increase my skills. To do a cable jointing, for example, I would sit for hours and hours and hours every day jointing cable, and then I'd do it in the darkness without any light. So I could joint cable at night, because you've got to do that at night in the field. And so I became very efficient at the job I was doing it. And I think that was one of the reasons I was promoted to rank of sergeant. Also, my background in the Palestine Police came into play again, because I was, although I say it myself, a very efficient drill instructor. I had made myself a very efficient drill instructor. I used to go out and drill a tree. It was called communication drill. And you would go out into the field and drill a tree, give it all the commands, and train your voice to give the commands. And I was then given the job of training the officers. A lot of new officers were coming in. And our CEO was a stickler for the officers had to know exactly the same as the men did. And I had the job of taking the officers every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning for an hour's foot drill, rifle drill, which I enjoyed very much. because I've always had a sort of affectionate contempt for officers. And I enjoyed that very much indeed.
How do you mean affectionate contempt?
Well, I met some very good officers, and I met a lot of rubbish. Particularly when the officer cadet training units were formed. We got absolute rubbish from them, particularly in the Far East. But officers that I served with, old regular officers, and men who came into the army, this is a strange thing, men who came into the army after the war started, who either volunteered to come in or some were conscripted into the army, who in Civvy Street had been businessmen, running their own business, well aware of how to deal with men, and had been used to doing that, and something suddenly happened, or didn't suddenly happen, but began to happen. We began to get officers who would do the job properly. They were studying the job. When they went for training courses, they'd really trained on the courses. They were enthusiastic. And when they came back, they knew how to look after a platoon or a company. They knew how to treat the men, when to be harsh with them, when to help them, and all that sort of thing. We got a different breed of officer. And some of them were excellent. Absolutely excellent. But in the main, I wasn't very keen about officers.
What kind of person do you think made the best officers?
Well, there was two types of officers. Now, I was very keen on public school boys when they grew up. I've never been to a public school. But these chaps came to us. The casualties amongst young officers were colossal. Now, they were patriots, these men. Patriotism was their number one thing. And they would expose themselves to danger, where I wouldn't. They'd stand up where I would lie down. I might be the better soldier at the finish, but the leadership was superb. And businessmen, people who'd been in business in Civvy Street. These two people I like best of all. I wasn't keen on men coming from the ranks being commissioned. They knew all the tricks. And they carried the tricks with them when they were commissioned. And I was never happy serving with people like that.
What kind of tricks do you have in mind?
Well, in the ranks, you learn, or a lot of men learn, all the tricks about scrounging and winning things and skiving and doing all sorts of things. And not really concentrating on the job they're in the army for. And that takes, you can't, that doesn't wear off. It doesn't wear off. I've served with ex-rankers who, when they were commissioned, thought they were God Almighty. And they weren't very good soldiers at all. The ones that were good soldiers were the men who particularly the youngsters, who didn't give a damn about danger or anything like that. They were there to do a job. And they were patriotic men. They weren't thinking about the money in their pocket because they didn't get much money. Young subalterns, second lieutenants, they were on a pittance. I mean, I could afford, as a sergeant, to drink beer at night. They couldn't. And if you were orderly sergeant, and you'd always ask the orderly officer into the sergeant's mess because he couldn't afford to buy beer, you'd ask him and have a few pints with him, you see. But, now I met some very fine officers, particularly very senior officers. I'm thinking about people like General Wavell, Slim, my own divisional commander, Lomax, men who never got into a flap, professional soldiers, you know. But the ordinary run-of-the-mill, commissioned rank, I didn't have very much time for.
Now, can you tell me how you got out to the Middle East in 1940?
Yes, we originally were going to leave. We were going to leave England in September 39 to go to France. That was the 55th Division. But as time went on, there was such an influx into the army that divisions were being diluted. And I was transferred to the 59th West Lancashire Infantry Division. And we finished up in Colwyn Bay with 2,500 men, and not enough instructors. So we had a struggle there for a month or two. But eventually I was given a what was called a line maintenance section, which I wasn't trained for. And there were 62 men in that. And we had an officer in command who was one of the finest officers I ever met, in fact. He was a man who had joined the army in 1915, served during the First World War, stayed in the army till 1926, had served in Greece and served in Russia. And he became my section officer. And we left Colwyn Bay in August 1940, and we went to Glasgow, to the King George V dock. And we went on board the Empress of Canada, and we sailed from there to Suez. We came ashore on lighters from a ship at Suez, and we got the train to a place called El Cantara, and we went back to Palestine. But we weren't there more than a fortnight, and we were moved then to Alexandria, and then we went into the desert. And my section was given the job of building an overhead telegraph route from outside Alexandria to Merzimetru. So that's how I landed up in the Middle East.
Can you tell me how the army got on with the Egyptians?
Not very well. Not very well. When we got there, when we got up the desert, things were quiet then, of course. The Italians had declared war in, I think it was June. I got up the desert in about October, and there's no shooting or anything like that. And the Egyptian army had got a lot of troops on the frontier, on the Libyan-Egyptian frontier. And they stayed there until the 7th Armored Division went through the wire and started the first advance. And as soon as the shooting started, they disappeared. They just disappeared out of our sight. We never saw anybody up there after that.
Because of lack of stomach for battle.
That's right. I did meet Arabs in towns because I didn't spend much time in towns at all. If I ever got back to Alexandria, it was simply to pick up spears or, or see if I could get some beer or something like that, and then get back up to my unit again. So we didn't really come in contact with a lot. I do remember some Egyptian signals coming along once, and examining the work we were doing on our overhead routes. And I'm afraid I had a bit of a barney with the Egyptian officer because I didn't want him anywhere near our work. But apart from that, we just didn't really know they were there.
What did this officer want to do?
Well, he, in actual fact, had climbed the top of the telegraph pole, and he was examining the joints and the jointing that we'd done at the top. And I when I saw him there, I told him in no uncertain language to get down off the thing and clear off. They were anti-British, the Egyptians, of course. They weren't on our side. And certainly Farouk, King Farouk wasn't on our side.
Were they in favour of the Italians?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Did they make that plain to you?
Well, nobody ever made that plain to me personally, but that was the general impression everybody had, that they were pro-Italian.
How did this work of yours go? Were there any problems?
There was no problems as far as the work was concerned, not the first during the first advance. We built our route very quickly, I might say, and it was with quite impossible conditions because We were using 28-foot telegraph poles with 4 8-way arms on it, which is quite. If you ask a GPO man, he would say that's quite impossible. However, we did that, and we had no problems at all except for the ground. People think the desert is all sand, but it isn't sand. For great stretches of the desert, it's hard rock. And we would have to get the Royal Engineers to come along and blast holes in the ground for us, to put our telegraph poles in. The trouble didn't start until the Germans arrived, because we build our telegraph routes in straight lines. And when the Germans arrived, there was a formation that arrived called Flieger Corps 10, I think it was. And they had fighter aircraft, and they had a bad habit of flying down the route of the telegraph poles. And we would be working on top of the poles, and they would fly down the route for two reasons. One, if there was a man at the top to shoot them, or secondly, to blow all the insulators off. That was very uncomfortable. Now, we had used ladders initially to climb these poles, but you couldn't get down a ladder very quickly. And so we reverted to the use of what we call climbing irons. And it's an iron strapped to your foot with a spike in it, and you climb the pole by sticking your feet into the spikes into the pole. You always then kept a lookout, and if you had an aircraft, you would call out and you would come down the pole at the quickest speed possible. So that inconvenienced and slowed the work down. But that didn't come along until the Germans arrived. The Italians gave us no problems at all like that.
What do you remember about the first advance against the Italians?
Well, we knew something was building up. We didn't know when it was going to happen. But we were usually in a position to know when there was a build-up of materials, because our supplies, we could get our supplies quickly, and there was plenty of them. We could see stuff being brought up, shells, ammunition, and all the various things that's required, and being stockpiled. So we knew something was happening, but we didn't know when it happened. We didn't know it had happened to start with, because Wavell sent the hussars through the wire, because Graziani had advanced to the air, and he'd stopped. He wasn't being aggressive at all, but Wavell was, and he sent the hussars through the wire. Initially, I think, as a reconnaissance. But when they came across the Italians, they surrendered in such numbers that he sent the whole 7th Armoured Division in, and everybody else like ourselves following in, you see. Our job changed then, and we went back to laying cable. And it was I think we advanced 400 miles. And the Italians were popping up all over the place surrendering. You suddenly find, and we ignored them. You'd suddenly find a dozen or 20 or 100 Italians coming along, and they'd spot British troops, and they'd come along towards you with their hands up, and we couldn't be bothered with them. And we just used to point in the direction of Egypt and let them walk on, because we couldn't do anything with them. They'd got rid of their arms. They weren't armed. But I think there was about 200,000 surrendered at the finish.
What condition were they in when you saw them?
Well, the only ones that I came in contact with were they were lousy. And I remember that we'd stopped one night before dusk to have a brew up. And there was quite a column of prisoners coming past. And we had a young Scots chap with us, who seemed to think there was good in everybody. So he got some tins of bully beef and some biscuits. And he went across this column of Italians. And he, for what good a few tins of bully beef were going to do, I don't know. But he gave them this food. And one of the Italians took off his pullover. They wore a green pullover, rather attractive pullover they were. And he handed it to this chap. Who put it on? Came back. And we thought nothing about it for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And then we all began to itch. We discovered eventually that we were covered in lice. And the only place we could think of was that this jersey had got some lice in it. They'd come back because they breed very quickly and they're a bloody menace. And that gave us a lot of problems. But they had vehicles in the desert which came along, and you could... what we did was you went to the back of this vehicle, and it was a steam thing inside, and you stripped all your clothes off and chucked them all into this big container, which... with a high-pressure steam or whatever it was, killed the lice. And all you had to do then was to get rid of them from your body. And when your uniform came back out, of course, it was clean then.
Were the Italian prisoners glum or happy?
Quite happy. I used Italian prisoners at one time as labour. And they were delighted if you went back to Alexandria to collect Italians. Because when they came with us, we fed them the same as we had. They got the same food as we had, which was better than the food in the prison camp. And they worked quite well. And if you happen to get one that spoke a bit of English, you know, we all sat round together. I on one occasion used German prisoners, but never again, because you couldn't trust them and they were arrogant and. Our troops wouldn't sit anywhere near them for their food, and they wouldn't sit anywhere near us to eat their food, and they wouldn't work. And if a man won't work, you can't make him work. So I used them once, and that was all. But we used them mainly on digging holes for our telegraph poles and digging deep holes for our cables to come into and switch blocks and things like that, you see. But the Italians were all right, but not the Germans.
You mean the Germans were trying to sabotage the work, were they?
They didn't. Well, I only had them with me for one day. They didn't try to sabotage anything, but they didn't want to work. And they were quite convinced that they were going to win the war. I mean, they were quite convinced they were going to win the war right up until they lost. And so with that attitude in mind, there's nothing you can do with them. But they really didn't want to work.
But the Italians were happy to work with them.
Oh, yes, because they got a good midday meal. They probably got hot stew and stuff like that, you see. We gave them cigarettes. That was no skin off our nose, because we were getting these filthy V-cigarettes, and we might as well poison the Italians as poison ourselves.
What other memories do you have of the advance against the Italians?
The memories of the advance against the Italians wasn't particularly notable. The first thing that was notable was our retreat from the Germans.